Hi there. Welcome to Our Rich Land, a podcast of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District, where we explore the outstanding efforts to improve, protect, and conserve our natural world right here in Richland County, Ohio. My name is Evan, a technician at Richland Soil and Water, and I co-host the program with the director of Kingwood Center Gardens, Josh Steffen.
Hey, I'm the other dude.
Our conversation with Kathy Smith, OSU's Forestry Program Coordinator, went so well last time that we had to split it into two episodes. Last time we talked, it was about maple syrup and how farming it can lead to healthy, well-managed forests. And in the second half of our interview, we dove into the nitty-gritty of forest ecology and restoration and some of the greatest management challenges facing Ohio's forests. Now, unfortunately, since this is the second half of last episode's recording, there are still some mic issues that we dealt with, especially Josh's mic again. But we will hopefully get those sorted out in future episodes. So, sorry about that, but without further ado, our second half conversation with Kathy Smith. All right, everybody, welcome back to our program. Talking to Kathy Smith here from OSU Extension about maple syrup, woodland management, and co-host Josh Steffen's got some really interesting questions that he'd like to fire off.
So this is where I take over, apparently, and ask those questions.
That could be scary.
Look at me and my prompts. So Kathy, as you can clearly read on your script, what innovative approaches are you seeing be used for reforestation versus practices that were used a decade ago or so? What or another way of asking similarly is, what is working and not working in your view for reforestation techniques today?
So I guess I'd start off with when I came into the business of being a forester, a field forester, in the 90s, we had a lot of cost share programs that encouraged people to convert highly erodible land to trees. And over time, the mechanisms for scoring have changed to
What do you mean by scoring?
So you apply, like for CRP, you apply and
CRP is what?
Conservation Reserve Program.
Excellent.
And so you apply and your land gets scored, and what you want to put in as a crop gets scored. And a lot of times in some areas, the warm season grasses now get more scoring points than trees. So what I've seen from the 90s, when it was nothing for me to handle a couple dozen tree planting plans for landowners based on the cost share programs, to today where there's not as much. There's still tree planting going on for landowners, but not nearly what we saw from that probably mid-80s when the Conservation Reserve Program started to today. And so it's a little hard to talk reforestation when you're talking such smaller numbers. But, it hasn't changed a whole lot in all this time. We're talking for landowners, typically bare root seedlings. And the only innovation that I've really seen in the arena of reforestation is utilizing seeds instead of bare root seedlings. So as a watershed forester, I was trying to encourage people to plant tree seedlings in those stream corridors that, hey, when we plant trees, it's March, April, and the stream's out of bank, and you can't get down in there and plant, or you do get in there and plant, and then you get a flooding scenario that wipes out what you just did. So we tried to flip folks to a fall seed planting where they'd be in the ground, they'd have time to put some roots down and make it through that spring flood. They wouldn't have to worry about the negative impacts. It never caught as much as I wish it would. I know there's still folks doing it. There's still folks reforesting in their woodlands with seed. The problem in a woodland, if you're trying to add some species diversity to a woodland and plant, if you try bare root seedlings, you're trying to put a bare root seedling into a wooded structure soil-wise, and so you can make a hole to put the tree in, but you got to be able to close all the oxygen out of that hole, and it's really hard when you have a mesh of tree roots that you're dealing with.
Right.
Seeds work well, but there's all this wildlife that roams out there, and it's like, ooh, what's buried there?
A farmer, there's the old adage, you plant three, one for the, right, one for the wildlife, one for the disease, and one for the farmer.
Right.
You know.
So you could put, you know, shelters and protective things over those seed if you want. I tried doing some underplanting in a stand I had that was heavy ash. Man, the raccoons would dig the seedlings out. You'd find them laying on the ground the next day. It was like, what are you doing to my trees? And then I tried some shelters over them. The deer would just pull them off. Something strange in their woods as they're walking through apparently was enough to curious, and they'd pull on them until I'd go a couple days later and they'd all be laying on the ground.
I feel the frustration.
Yeah. So it's, there isn't a whole lot new.
Mm-hmm.
It's the diligence of the person putting the planting in. I mean, you really do have to stay on top of it.
Yeah, I sent, you know, I sent Evan a YouTube video.
Yeah, I watched that this
morning.
That
was, how would you sum up what that video was all about?
So, it's, well, the grab phrase was, we're doing reforestation wrong, or there has been wrong examples of reforestation. I think one of them was a forest in Israel.
Yeah.
Where they replanted in a habitat that wasn't really suited to be forest.
Mm-hmm.
So it actually captured more heat and increased.
Well, it changes the, it actually increases the low, I wouldn't say global climate, but the local temperature
local
levels
climate,
because
yeah.
There's, instead of that getting reflected back off in the sand, it's getting absorbed and held there by darker colors.
So and there's all these programs that you hear about that just chuck trees in the ground, and there's monocultures, and just to be aware that planting forests takes thought and planning and intentionality.
You have to know your soils. You have to know your site. I mean, I get questions all the time. I want to plant black walnut. It's like, well, do you have black walnut soils? I remember working with a landowner who just was adamant in his conservation reserve plan. He was going to plant black walnut. It was mediocre black walnut soils. And I said that to him. I said, let's put some other species in so that we're not talking a monoculture and you get something that grows, because I think the walnut are going to struggle. He'd have me out every year. They're not growing. And it's like, do you remember the conversation we had about
No,
this?
He doesn't. Conveniently forgets, right?
So it really is understanding the site, the soils, and the pressures. I mean, you put a planting in, and the next day the deer have gone down the row and done a buffet with the tops out of all the trees. That's a problem. And you need to be able to try to deal with that. And as much as we talk about deer proof,
I mean
they'll gnaw on,
right?
If they're curious, they'll gnaw on anything.
There's so many challenges. Coming from the gardener's perspective, we deal in smaller, obviously, you know, square footage management. So I don't know how foresters can just even begin to deal with the sheer volume of ground to manage and foster along and so forth. I mean, I think one of the challenges is it's obviously nearsighted, as you know, thinking, and instead of looking at the long term, really even beyond you and really working with succession, right? So if you want walnuts, or maybe actually your grandchildren have walnuts,
right?
You got to put in succession species that are going to, like we were just talking offline about how certain species will change the soil chemistry to their advantage, and walnuts no different.
if you have a roadmap of plant trees that you can plant, you know, that are short term or are nursery trees, and there's a lot of more ecologically focused approaches than, you know, 12 foot on center or 8 foot or whatever it is that you're doing, right, in a grid pattern, blah, 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 and the seed being a better option, as she was referring to. Did we was that recorded or was that offline when we were talking about that?
I think we talked about
it. Did we just talk about that? Mm-hmm. Shows you how well I'm paying attention. but that's exactly right, because why often it's so frustrating for us as gardeners, we put a plant in the ground and it just struggles, and then you have a volunteer, same species, great next to it, and it's just we're doing great. And it's because it grew up with the soil ecology, the microbiota that are there, right? And so ripe tree, right place. That's a dictum of the gardening world, and it's a dictum of the forest world too.
Yeah.
Of just good sustainable planting.
Well, and it's, you know, like I said, riparian buffers. You got to have trees that can tolerate standing water for certain lengths of time.
What does riparian mean?
So tree plantings along the stream, where you're creating a forest, a streamside forest.
Why is that important?
Because they filter out different nutrients and pesticides and things before it gets to the water source that you're planting along. So you're trying to clean some water. But, you know, one of the questions I'd always ask is, so does it flood? Yeah, it floods. How long does the water stay up? Because if you tell me it's up for a day and then it's down, that's less of an issue for some species. But if you tell me it could be up for a week, that's a different tree species totally that mm-hmm. you're going to want to put in there, because there are some that can tolerate a week or more of flood conditions, but there's some that can't do that. And so even though it may be a wet site tree, you got to know how much water sits there and for what length of time.
Plant a silver maple, they can grow on anything. Speaking of.
Sycamores.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've unfortunately, as Middle Eastern into Western, agriculture, we have for millennia have used annual production, right? That's just how we do things. We clear the land and then, try to grow an annual crop on it, which is not how nature works.
So, it seems like we've never learned our lesson. I use the example for people who are totally new to this concept. So if you've ever heard, growing up in elementary school, we learned the term fertile crescent, right? Which is the area between Euphrates and the Tigris, right? That was where supposedly the cradle of agriculture began, or at least one of them. And so it must have been lush.
At one point. And what is it now, right? It's just one big desert.
Right.
So I'm sure there's a lot of factors that went into making it a desert, but one of them being how we produced, right? And so we've got to look at maybe a different way of growing our food. And forest systems, like a food forest, like we mentioned, is one option. It's not the only. There's no silver bullet.
Right.
Right. But have you seen any systems where food crops and livestock can, you know, no, most people don't think of livestock even in a forest system as a part of an integrated part of a forest system. Have you seen any research on that?
So it's a practice called silvopasture, where you're growing trees and you rotate livestock into those areas.
What's the point of doing that?
You know, part of it is the dual purpose of having grazing opportunities while also growing, hopefully, high dollar value trees. Because a lot of times it's walnuts and things that either can give you a nut crop or a high dollar value veneer product on the timber that comes out. What you have to watch are the soils that you're on, because here in Ohio, there's places where I can take you into a woods and show you still some of the damage from 50 plus years ago where the woods were grazed, and you can still see the damage to the trees where they were just, you know, kind of left go in the woods. So it can be managed, and it has to be managed, because if you just turn them loose, the trees are going to suffer from the compaction around the root systems.
Right.
So it's what I call a high management system. You're going to rotate them in, but boy, you got to make certain you rotate them out when you need to. And we don't have, I mean, we have some that are looking at that in southern Ohio, but we don't have a lot of it in Ohio. There's more maybe in the Northeast in particular areas, and definitely more towards the Midwest, like Missouri and that are using those systems. Some of it is just the clay content of our soils just does not make it super compatible.
Sure, or compactable.
Mm-hmm. So it makes it very compactable.
Right, right. So it's not
the system for everybody or in every situation.
Right. Every site, you need to make certain that you know exactly what soils you're on and what condition they're currently in. Because, I mean, we have some soils on the Mansfield campus that a couple of us were just out there digging, and there's an area that 40 plus years it's been let go, and there's no plants growing on it. There's trees on every side, but there's no plants in this patch. We went digging, and there was like a 3-inch frangipane on the top where there's no roots in it. There's no passages for anything. And it's also why that site, when it's wet, is just like a slick, because there's no way for water to drain down through.
How big of a spot of patch is that?
You know, it's probably 50, 60 feet wide and that long. I mean, it's an area right off one of the blacktop trails. If you look at some of the historical photos, we think it was the trail back to a livestock area. You can kind of see some pen areas on an old 50 photo that looks like they maybe had livestock back in there at some point. You know, that's part of knowing the history of the site you're on.
Yeah, if you're looking to take your wooded lot, I mean, almost everything is secondary or third, tertiary. Right. I don't even know if there's such thing as tertiary growth, but land use history is so critical to future plans.
So that's part of certainly where I'm from. I'm a Michigander.
Ugh.
I know. Take a deep breath. we didn't have a great, you know, the state wasn't great for agriculture and huge chunks of it, right? It's big swamp and a lot of it. Or just really rocky, sandy ground for pines.
Right.
But the cleared cut.
So much of it, right? And for the town next, so I'm from Midland, Michigan, home of Dow Chemical. And next door was Bay City, and that's where a lot of the board from the lumber rush came from. And they talk about how the lumber rush at one point was even more profitable than the gold rush. In certain years. And so, I mean, it's just that we just don't realize how drastically we've changed the face of the ecosystems around here.
And we still do.
Yeah, yeah, it's still going on. So that was all a setup for this last part of this question, apparently. So I'm sure it'll get edited out. Is there a way, do you feel that some, I did say that, didn't I? That they could coexist in the same square foot. You would just have to really, you can't bring in some cookie cutter solution. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah.
Really know and work with an extension agent.
You're going to have to work with someone. I always say, you know, try to work with a professional forester when you're doing some of this so that you do put the pieces together, the right pieces on the right site, because you can spend a boatload of money trying to accomplish something on the wrong site. And that's worse than anything else, because you get discouraged, you walk away, and what's left behind, you're either going to sell the property and someone else is going to have to try to fix it. And usually fixing it in some of those scenarios is the bulldozer comes in and takes all the trees out and converts it to something else. You know, when crop prices go up, we see our woodlands get cleared off. And I'm always amazed. I watched one down the road from me that cleared off a woods when the crop prices really went, like maybe about 10 years ago, and cleared it off and took 3 years before they really could get a crop in that field. They kept working it and different things. Mm-hmm. By the time, you know, the 3 years was up, the crop prices had started to come back down. And I'm like, so if you'd have managed that woods, could you maybe have made more money from the woods, harvesting the trees properly than what, you know, you did with the crop? And so sometimes when landowners make those decisions, there's other things that are factoring into that. And those are things that we can't control when we're talking like crop prices and property taxes and stuff like that. I mean, it happens. Both of those instances have an impact on our woodlands in Ohio. I mean, there's nothing like getting your property tax bill and seeing that it went through the roof and getting a phone call from that woodland owner that, hey, what can I do? Yeah. You know, do I sell all the trees? Do I, you know, all of a sudden they're trying to keep the property and figuring out a way of being able to make
mitigate
it pay.
That.
Yeah. So both of those instances can have a huge impact. They can exactly grow together. I mean, let's face it, most of our woodlands today are left on pieces of ground that were not prime ag ground or they'd have been cleared years ago. When I worked in Western Ohio, I can remember walking woods in Union County in my knee boots because of the water in a pin oak stand, you know? Mm-hmm, and so there's reasons they're still in a woods, but we also have ways of being able to mitigate some of that. And you see trees disappear all the time. So,
Okay.
Well, I think that, I mean, the one, it's you can't ignore economics when you're a conservationist.
Right.
It's not all about the earth. And because it's sort of a balancing act that's, some people, I have a hard time sometimes with hardcore people to kind of, you know, like, look, there's no one simple solution.
No.
You have to create a system from scratch.
Right.
With some tried and true tools that are out there. Don't fight the site, by the way.
Right.
That's another old adage.
Yeah. Don't fight the site.
Don't fight the site, I was told in college.
I always say don't fight Mother Nature because she'll win in the end.
Oh, absolutely.
And she'll just laugh at you for what you were trying to do.
Absolutely.
Hello again. Evan butting in here for a quick minute or two. Want to give a shout out to you, the listener. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to listen to our program. Thank you for being curious and engaging with conservation and environmental issues. If you like this program and think it's worth sharing, then please do. If you feel we have deserved a like or even a subscription, well, we welcome that also. If not, no worries. We are glad you are here and listening. All right, enough from me. Back to the conversation.
So as a seasoned forester and conservationist, what are some of the bigger challenges you've seen to forest health
kind of long term?
Right. What worries you the most?
And then I think
in this area.
Yeah, especially in Richland County here.
Yeah, we want to talk about Richland County.
Invasive species.
Why so? What is an invasive species and by your definition?
So a non-native invasive species is not native to the area. And plant-wise, they compete so well. Most of them green up before our natives do and stay green past the time our natives would. And so they push out our native plant material big time. And then on the pests, I mean, look what emerald ash borer did to our woodlands here in Richland County and across the state. Insects and diseases are harder to deal with. I mean, right now, spotted lantern fly is moving across the state. When you tell me that we've found it in this easternmost county and then the next county we find it in is Cuyahoga County, I'm like, there's a boatload of distance between those two finds.
Yeah.
The odds are it's right there, you know, in between the two. And so it is really difficult. We try to just push the information on the pests, especially. It's like find it early so that we can try to deal with it. But that's hard. And then the plants, you know, the plant and the plant material, what it can do to the soils, what it can do to the forest. I mean, these non-native invasive plants can almost stop a woods from having any regeneration at all. I've got some pictures I use in presentations. It's a woods, but the entire understory is burning bush. Mm-hmm. There's no young seedlings coming up in that woods at all. It's big trees, burning bush. We've mm-hmm. got that in big trees and autumn olive, mm-hmm. or big trees and bush honeysuckle. I mean, we have, and privet is another one. Privet's probably a little heavier here in Richland County than bush honeysuckle is. Mm. But we need to, I mean, and I admit, in my first probably decade of my career, you saw them, but we didn't really talk about them. Right. We didn't think too much about them until all of a sudden we realized when we walked into wooded areas that it was solid bush honeysuckle. It was solid garlic mustard. Mm. And what are the impacts? Well, the allelopathic chemicals that fight off all the competition, so it's just them that can grow.
So that's, those are chemicals that the roots of the plant are mm-hmm. releasing into the soil to
right.
kill off the neighbor.
Then you have things like ailanthus, which is a host plant for spotted lanternfly. So, yeah, you know,
it's called tree of heaven to all you sporophytes.
Which Forest Service friend of mine says that's too nice of a name mm-hmm. for it. Yeah, so she no, won't use it.
It's, an amazing adaptive tree.
It's a host plant for spotted lanternfly. So we're all going,
because it's Asian, right?
Yeah,
those are both Asian. So you got all these invasives that are coming over.
So we're going, yes, kill the ailanthus, right? But guess what? It ain't going to happen. And it just attracts spotted lanternfly. In ailanthus itself, a mature tree can produce over 300,000 seeds that are 90% viable. Yeah, it's
successful.
Like...
And grow in absolute crap soil.
Right. Oh, yeah. Can grow in a crack in a sidewalk and be as happy.
In my last job, I had a ailanthus that was growing literally,
I don't know, maybe 10 feet down from a sewer.
Mm-hmm.
And the leaves were coming up through the grate.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that's success.
Yeah.
That's a plant that is very successful.
I have pictures of Japanese knotweed coming up through the blacktop.
Yeah.
On a trail that had been blacktopped.
Yeah.
It's pushing up the blacktop and growing up through. So, yeah, they have a very strong will to live, and if we're not paying attention, the trees compete with them for nutrients and moisture, for water. The trees lose out because most of these non-native invasive plants, roots are shallower, so they get all the good stuff off the top, and the tree is stressed because it's competing just to survive.
And a lot of these are opportunists that are really sometimes pioneer species. And I mean, so there's bigger, you have to ask why are they able to move in, right? It's because the conditions are right for them. So what's causing the conditions to be right for them?
Mm-hmm.
Some of those are the larger climate issues.
Right. And some of them, you know, are all the dead ash trees. So what's coming in?
Right.
It's all the non-native invasives that are coming in and filling those gaps that were created by standing dead trees.
I was taught, you know, whenever you have a pollution or an excess, it's because something is out of balance, right? So... Or if there's a deficiency, again, out of balance, it's like in the garden we talk about, you don't have a slug problem, you have a duck deficiency,
mm-hmm.
right?
And so it's a lot of times you're a systems manager. So figuring out what you need to add to the system or take away.
Right.
Why do I have too much of this thing? Well, it's because it's gluttoning on,
mm-hmm.
right? When there's a big dead animal in the woods. If you ever watch time lapse of photography, right? What happens? Big party at the carcass, right?
Oh yeah,
everybody shows up, blah, 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 and that's what's happening in nature, right? It's Kool-Aid, and everybody is showing up, taking advantage of whatever opportunity is there. So, some of the ways to control and fight those things is
getting rid of the extra somehow. Great theory,
yeah, or anyway. Rebalancing.
Right,
I did a lot of research in college on trophic cascades because that really fascinated me, how ecosystems could change ecologically and even however you say that, geomorph.
We like throwing around big words, folks.
Geomorphologically?
Sure, and we make up words.
But there's a famous study in Yellowstone where they return wolves, and it actually changes the course of the river because...
Downstream effects.
Right. Exactly. Because the presence of the wolves keeps deer and caribou moving along instead of just eating in one spot. So instead of eating in one spot on the riverbanks, they move along, and then what's left that was there originally regrows and stabilizes the banks so that the course of the river
Once it gets back to the whole grazers, browsers among trees in farm systems, right? Usually you have to highly manage them and move for the same reason, right? They naturally would be moving rather than being sedentary in one spot. So you have to have smaller paddocks that are you're moving them around and through and keeping them kind of mob grazing or whatever they call it.
That works.
So what are some of the biggest achievements in woodland management? Or what do you find most promising in this area?
Well, that's hard to think about just Richland County. I mean, if you look at the state, I think that when we try to do outreach or one-on-one technical assistance, I mean, I think there's a lot of great resources out there if folks will just take advantage of them. And so I think that's where we've made some strides with both Extension and Soil and Water, Division of Forestry, Division of Wildlife. We've got resources and we've gotten better at digital resources and publications that can help folks with their management decisions and how they're trying to figure out their path ahead. I hope that they're being applied better. It's very hard to get a handle on that, though. So you talk to, you know, I talk to landowners all the time, but I'm also probably talking to the ones that are most likely to be doing things because they call Extension and they're asking questions. So I think the challenge on the other side is, while I think we're better at responding and helping them with resources, I think the challenge on the other side is those that we haven't reached and how
people to
right 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 exactly but how do we get to them? I mean, if they're not digital people, which it's something that we've struggled with, we do a paper newsletter and we're just gonna get back into that after almost 2 years. But I know that we've put out a boatload of digital stuff, but I also know I have landowners that just don't do the online stuff. That's just not them. And so you don't want to lose them. But then how do you break through to the other folks that...
Next generation.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's the challenge in all of it. It's for all of us as we work with landowners.
We have... the conservation district here has... We're always, like, trying to think of ways... Especially me right now and one of my coworkers, because we're doing this big thing called H2 Ohio, and it's a water quality thing, and it's focusing on farmers. And your average farmer in Richland County is an older gentleman. So reaching out to them, someone who's in that generation, and just trying to make contact with them has been difficult.
Yeah.
And Richland County, our office is like in the stages right now of growing relationship with our farmers, mostly because, like, in the past we've had very limited staff and haven't had like huge agricultural programs and don't have as much agricultural land as surrounding counties.
Right. So it's why, you know, for me, the maple adds a little bit of a twist. Can I pull people in with maple syrup and the production thereof and talk about woodland management? You know, what you need to do to have healthy trees that will produce high quality syrup. So it's a little bit different approach than what we've tried before. But again, you got to keep trying. But I think that's all of the natural resource professionals. I think that's our biggest challenge, is We have steady audiences. When I started with Extension, we used to laugh and say the same 35 people are coming to all of our programs because they're fans. Right. Well, you know, that's great, but...
You can only see Betty and Gerard at the same one for so long.
Right? Well, I used to have a tree farmer that came to every program we did. Didn't matter how many times he'd been through the program. Right. He just enjoyed it so much. Sure. He came, and that's great.
Right.
But it's like, how do I move on and add to?
Right.
Because you don't want to chuck them out of the nest, so to speak. But you need to be able to grab other folks' attention. And so I've done some of the Master Gardener programming. I've done some of our Volunteer Naturalist programming, trying to really push the woodland angle in both of those programs. And it has helped. I mean, because now I've got some Master Gardeners that maybe aren't woodland owners, but they're advocates. And so when they talk to their clientele, they're like, oh, you need to talk to Kathy because she can help you with. And so that's a little more non-traditional. But I think that's what we have to keep.
Well, not as an aside, but as an aside, that's exactly where one of the ways that public gardens interface and help with
educators in other aspects of environmental education. I mean, Kingwood is a wooded site. Right, that needs management. So Kathy will be coming to visit Kingwood. In my past job, we had a woodland garden, a native woodland garden that we had to create a management plan and set up for. I plan on doing that for us.
Mm-hmm.
But that's exactly those opportunities that taking. I find that we're going to have to use more and more horticultural techniques. And really treat our woodland systems
as gardens, you know, from ecological gardens, right?
Right.
But that's going to require more hands and boots on the ground to make those techniques really possible and work, right? The days of one forester for 10,000 hectares or whatever.
I used to cover 10 counties in Western Ohio.
That's just not sustainable. That's just not going to work.
Yeah.
Granted, we also have smaller and smaller wooded lots anyway with greater fragmentation. So maybe we can get to that point where we get small enough, right, that we can manage
it. No. Right? I don't want to get there.
But it can go back then the other way.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Right. As you get more people involved. So those gardeners are a great resource on that front. So we'll hopefully Kingwood can help pitch in Richland County and help with the woodland
and
issues.
That's what happened with Emerald Ash Borer. When Emerald Ash Borer hit Ohio, you had the foresters and then you had all the urban foresters, the horticulturists. And we started sitting down in meetings because an ash tree is an ash tree, whether it's sitting on your city lot or whether it's out in the woods. And so now I have a lot of our horticultural specialists that teach in our woodland stewards programs, you know, like a Joe Boggs that does the entomology and Amy Stone and Eric Draper. Before that, we probably never would have crossed paths. But Emerald Ash Borer, for all of its horrendous impact on us, brought us to the table.
It's breaking on the walls of the paradigms you know, you have natural systems and you have, you know, I preach to my staff that, like,
the garden's an ecosystem, whether you want to admit it or not, so treat it like it is.
Right.
So, you know, it's the same thing, just slight different variations, right? A little less human influence and a little more human influence.
Well, Kathy, this has been a fantastic conversation.
He's trying to wrap up.
Really
He's
enjoyed it.
Super ready to get out of here.
He's thinking about the editing.
Cheeseburger.
Cheeseburger. That's true.
Well, what did you think?
Hey, I liked it. Thanks for recommending the episode. I gotta tell you the truth, though. There were a lot of technical terms in there that just went over my head. Can you explain some of those?
Oh, like what?
Well, let me pull out my little notepad where I wrote them all down.
Hit me with them.
So, they mentioned a monoculture, but didn't really explain it. What's that?
Oh, yeah. So a monoculture is pretty much a group of plants that are all exactly the same, like a cornfield or a forest with only red pine in it. Typically, monocultures are man-made, because nature loves diversity.
Huh. Cool. Soil chemistry. What's that about?
Soil chemistry is basically the chemical makeup of the soil. For instance, how much of certain types of naturally occurring elements, like nitrogen or phosphorus, are in the soil.
Oh, that's interesting. They also mentioned the word microbiota. What's that?
So microbiota are microorganisms, like bacteria, viruses, or fungi, that occupy specific environments, including soil, and are even found inside and outside the human body.
Oh, gross. Okay. What is a frangipane? Is that some kind of weird growth?
Nope. Frangipane occurs in soil. It describes a layer of soil that water can't get through, usually consisting of clay. This layer has become compacted over time. It is not good soil for growing plants.
Oh, okay, that makes more sense. And there was this long word that started with a G. Geomorphology.
Geomorphology. It simply means having to do with the form of the Earth's land. So when they were referring to the river in Yellowstone, the Earth's surface actually changed due to a renewed predator-prey relationship. Ah, gives me goosebumps.
Oh, well, that's pretty neat. Well, thanks.
Our Rich Land is a production of Richland Soil and Water Conservation District in Mansfield, Ohio. Our director is Erica Thomas, our public relations coordinator is Teresa Suter, and we are your hosts, Evan Stern and Josh Steffen. Check out the links in the show notes if you want to learn more about some of the topics we talked about today. For instance, we put OSU's Woodland Stewards website back there. Just wanted to reiterate kind of what that's all about. In their own words, the Woodland Stewards promote stewardship across the woodlands of Ohio through classes, professional workshops, and publications. And their website is brimming with resources to check out, including information on invasive species specific to Ohio. So it's a good place to go for woodland managers of all knowledge levels. Also in the show notes, we've linked the video that Josh and I discussed at the beginning of the episode about how we are getting tree planting wrong and how to do better, and what hope there is for the world's forests and climate. So you can check that out. Richland Soil and Water Conservation District is a not-for-profit organization offering education and technical guidance to Richland County residents and landowners for their natural resource needs. Our numerous events, programming, publications, information videos, stormwater permit applications, and much more can be found on our website, richlandswcd.net. That's richlandswcd.net. Please also go check out Kingwood Center Gardens, where you can walk amongst flower gardens, duck ponds, and sweeping lawns, and perhaps see a pet peacock or two. You can check out what they've got going on by following their link in the show notes or by visiting kingwoodcenter.org. It would make Josh very happy, I'm sure. If you liked what you heard today, please consider donating to support this and other programs administered by Richland SWCD. You can contact us by visiting our website. We'll be back in another episode to talk about more conservation stuff. Stay tuned. See you later.